Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 5, The Pencil of War. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. This episode is really dear to my heart. It is about the Bosnian genocide through the lens of two very special guests. First, we'll be hearing from a man who was an American soldier serving at the time of the genocide in Bosnia, a proud soldier who happens to be my brother, Chris Gruel. The next segment will be our diary of the day, where once again we'll be bringing you an excerpt from our book, The Freedom Writer's Diary. Then finally, our featured discussion is with Zlata Filipovic, author of the best-selling book, Zlata's Diary, A Child's Life in Sarajevo, and now an activist and documentary filmmaker. Zlata paints a vivid picture of what the war was like to live firsthand in Sarajevo as a child. She also shares her thoughts about the dangers of labels and the importance of living to be the light in a very dark place. The title, The Pencil of War, is a metaphor written by a young girl in a basement as bombs are going off and electricity is being cut and people are being buried, about how children stop being children and how the adults become these kids, marking on people based on ethnicity and religion, race and culture, labels, stereotypes. Now, over 20 years later, this discussion of atrocities, civil strife, and genocide, unfortunately, seems even more relevant today. As you listen to these stories, I invite you to ponder that metaphor, the pencil of war, and ask yourself, what can I do to create light in the midst of darkness? And then share it with others to help ease or even erase their pain and their suffering. Now here he is, joining us by phone today, my brother, Chris Gruel.
I'm Chris Gruel. I joined the Army in summer of 1990, and in that time I was stationed in Europe and traveled several times to Sarajevo and other parts of the former Yugoslavia during the civil war that was unfolding at that time. I'll be honest, I haven't talked about this or thought about this for years. I still probably haven't processed some of those experiences. It was an awful time for anyone who was there and to even feel that somehow my hardships at all amount to anything would be really unfair. So the first time I was in Bosnia was for the handing over of the airport to the United Nations. There had been a whole bunch of fighting for this airfield. The United Nations kind of came in and just parked itself right in the middle of that siege of Sarajevo. So I wasn't an officer. I'm just a kind of low man on the totem pole. But I think that everyone was just confused at what was going on. It was just hard to understand who was on which side, and the sides seemed to keep kind of changing. And I remember it was a no man's land, right? So you had these areas, like in one of those old war movies, where neither side is in control. And this young guy and gal had tried to run across to get from one neighbor to another and were killed. I don't remember anybody ever calling it Romeo and Juliet, but here you had this young man and woman who had been murdered, and nobody would go out and do anything to get their bodies. And that was just a sense of absolute helplessness. I remember at that time in my life thinking, you know, what's the point of having the United Nations or NATO if they can't do anything to stop the problem that's right in front of our face, right? Like, what permission do you need if you have the ability to go someplace to protect people? You should be able to protect them. And I just remember being at that time, why aren't we doing something except standing around? Everyone knows, hey, these snipers aren't going to shoot at us. Why can't we just go out there and at least take care of those bodies? There's just something really bad going on where you have kids who are getting killed right next to the United Nations who are there to protect these people, and they're not doing anything to protect them. I left the Army in the summer of 94 to go to college. You know, I hadn't thought that much about Sarajevo. I spent a lot of years challenged with some of those experiences, but My sister has always had the ability to get me to follow her on any crazy adventure. And so Aaron asked me if I would go on a trip to Europe with the Freedom Riders after they graduated from high school. And I was super excited to join them and was honored to be included. It was a crazy itinerary from London to Amsterdam to Poland. And I really was surprised to see that our trip was also going to Sarajevo. I'll say if there's one thing the Army did prepare me for was how to wrangle a bunch of young people. So I spent that time having a great time marching around a bunch of really great Freedom Riders. But honestly, I was surprised to be back. It was an odd feeling to go back to that airport because it wasn't that much after. It was only 99, so the war was... It hadn't been that long. It hadn't changed that much. There were still burned out planes and old blown up tanks still sitting around in that neighborhood. It had looked like it had gone through a battle of World War II. It was still there. But I honestly didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the bad stuff that had happened because I was there with a bunch of Freedom Riders. I definitely saw the connection very quickly when I heard Freedom Riders talking about what it was like having people in their family that had been murdered close to where they're supposed to be safe, and then to hear about this little girl coming from an environment that was equally traumatic, and all of those people being brought together by Aaron to learn about how that was a horrible experience, but there's something to be gained out of that was pretty unique, pretty special. What I learned from meeting Zlata is that in the middle of this horrible environment, there's still something that's very special inside of people. The fact that a very young girl had the grace and the spirit and tenacity to write about that. I'm a 45-year-old guy now, and I can't string together two sentences to describe any of this stuff. It's pretty special that a little girl who, you know, had much more to lose and did and had a much tougher time than I could ever experience was able to share that with kids all around the world and help them survive those tough times in their lives.
For the Freedom Riders, we often joke that family is what you choose and family is what you make. But I love sharing my actual family with you, our listeners. So just as Chris Grillo was my baby brother, he became the Freedom Riders' older brother. And with each and every escapade we had, he was there with me in the trenches as a chaperone. And what I learned from him was this may be the perfect bridge for me to take students from Long Beach, California, and teach them to put down their fist, to put down their gun, and to write a very different ending to a very different story. The Freedom Riders not only read Zlata's diary, but wrote her letters, begging her to hop on a plane, fly across the globe, and meet teenagers who were the same age as her. When Zlata decided to come and visit the Freedom Riders, it was magic. We could ask questions about those moments that humanize and make things personal. About losing a friend, about losing your innocence, about not being able to sleep through the night because of PTSD, because of mortars and bombs and bullets. Even though Zlata was meeting world leaders, presidents, and the like, even though she had a best-selling book translated in multiple languages, we all realize that we are much more similar than we are different. One of those young freedom writers that my brother helped wrangle was Cynthia Ray, and she is going to be reading the diary of the day about meeting Zlata Filipovich. Today's diary is diary number 47.
Dear diary, knowledge comes in strange ways. I never thought that a person who lived over 10,000 miles away could impact me, but tonight, that changed. Zlata has been with us for 4 days now, and we've really gotten to know her well, and she's just like us. If I hadn't known that she was Zlata Filipovich, the famous teen author from war-torn Bosnia, I would have just assumed that she was a normal 15-year-old girl who liked to shop and hang out with her friends. The best part is that she was a normal 15-year-old girl. As Zlata was speaking, there was one thing that really stands out in my mind. As she was answering questions, a couple of adults asked her what ethnicity she was. Croatian? Muslim? Serbian? I was upset that instead of getting the message that she was trying to convey, they were too preoccupied with the nationality she was. Were these the same adults that preached how wrong racism and discrimination are? Were these the same people that a minute ago agreed that we shouldn't care about labels? Zlata looked around, stared at us, and simply said, "I'm a human being." That's exactly what we all are. We spend so much time trying to figure out what race a person is when we could just get to know them as individuals. I feel like answering their questions with a question. Does it matter? Will it make a difference if she's Croatian, Muslim, Serbian? She taught me the most valuable lesson that anybody could ever have, and to think that she is only 15. Ever since that day, I've tried not to accept society's labels, but to fight against them. Now, if you ask me what race I am, like Zlata, I simply say, I'm a human being.
The idea of bringing Zlata Filipovic into our classroom was overwhelming and daunting, but I realized if she actually came, it would change everything. She would bring history to life. She would take those words on a page and make them dance and sing. There would be so many activities that we could do before, during, and after. The students wouldn't pack up their bags and leave when the bell rang or their pencil was put down or that test was over. What I have found since is that same sentiment when teachers across the globe reach out to me and the foundation, inviting a Freedom Rider into their school, into their very classroom, whether they do it with a video chat or an in-person visit. It changes everything. So if you're interested in bringing a Freedom Rider to your class, feel free to reach out to us. Send us an email at podcast@freedomridersfoundation.org. And we will select the perfect Freedom Rider with the perfect message for your class, for your lesson, for your legacy. I'm so excited for you to hear our featured discussion with Zlata Filipovic. She joined us via Skype all the way from Ireland to share her stories and her message with all of you listeners. So here it is, my conversation with my dear friend, Zlata Filipovic. It is such an honor for a friend, a colleague, and an activist to be joining us on this podcast journey. For those of you that are readers of the Freedom Rider's Diary, what was so important for us was to have a foreword written by somebody that we hold in respect. And so the fact that Zlata Filipovic wrote our foreword has been a gift that keeps giving. Zlata has been in our lives since the Freedom Riders were sophomores in high school and has been an advocate and an activist ever since. So I'd like to introduce Zlata Filipovic to all of our listeners. Welcome, Zlata.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's been a great 22 years of knowing each other and watching you and your students and your foundation and your teachers grow and continue spreading a message that I think we all agree on and believe in.
Zlata is joining us from Ireland. She lives in Dublin, but still continues to be a world traveler. And Zlata, what I'd love to do is, for our listeners, can you take us back to your childhood? The country of your origin has changed names and borders and boundaries. But if you could take us back to where you were born and that change that has happened through the years.
Yeah, so I was born in Sarajevo, which is the capital of Bosnia, which was one of the six republics that formed what was then known as Yugoslavia. So I guess I was Yugoslav, I was Bosnian, I was Sarajevan, I was nothing and nobody and a kid and somebody very much living what I now realize was a very kind of perfect childhood. I was an only child to professionals, you know, living in the center of the capital city. My dad was a lawyer and came from a lineage of lawyers. My mom was a chemical engineer. We had lots of family friends. Being an only child, I think friends were very important. But I also knew how to spend time on my own and sort of keep myself busy and occupy myself. And I did lots of, you know, those activities that I now see, you know, other 8, 9, 10 year olds, you know, living happily in sort of lovely middle class households in Ireland, which is where I live now. You know, I went to school and music school, and I was learning English from the age of 5. And we had beautiful mountains around Sarajevo, which is where we had the Olympic Games when I was 4 years old. So we all had fantastic facilities and went skiing and went to the lovely, beautiful Croatian coast in the summers, and just had this kind of very ideal existence that, you know, I didn't know was ideal until the moment it all completely changed. What was happening is that the year that I was born was the same year that the president of Yugoslavia, Tito, died. So I guess I came in the wake of that. And Tito had been a president from the end of the Second World War, which is when Yugoslavia in its form as it was known then was formed. And from there on, you know, I guess things were starting to change, probably. Nobody could see, certainly not my parents. But essentially what was resulting that the six countries, the six republics that made Yugoslavia, that were held together, perhaps, you know, through different forces and elements during the time of Tito's life and reign, were starting to seek independence. And there was a sense of ethnic tensions and nationalism on the rise, and these identities were starting to change. And this was all sort of happening all around me, all around my happy ideal existence of going to, you know, piano lessons and choir practice. But it was coming, and we didn't see it. And I think that's sort of always an interesting kind of concept. And my parents, who very much were kind of Yugoslavs and believed in that idea, particularly didn't see it. You know, I can't claim too much for myself. I was only, you know, 9. But I think there's also this kind of element where you're trying to push things away that you don't want to happen to you. So you think that they happen to other people. So whether it's, you know, cancer or just terrible things, that war, poverty, hunger, all these things, they happen to other people. And that's, I guess, the way I was viewing anything kind of quote unquote bad, you know, especially war and conflict. It was something that I was aware of on the news in terms of happening in other places in the world. I was aware of it in history, you know, studying the Second World War, etc. But I just didn't think, and none of us thought, that it can happen to us. And, you know, if you believe that it happens to other people, you're kind of almost going, and because I am different to other people, it will not happen to me. And then it did. In a kind of a spring's day in 1992, war came to Bosnia, it came to Sarajevo, despite us never believing it would be possible. And it came into my life and my family's life and all of our lives, and sort of change them utterly and forever.
I just began teaching, and I'll never forget seeing your face on the cover of Newsweek, and you were hailed as the modern day Anne Frank. As Anne Frank wrote to Kitty, you were writing to Mimi. So for our listeners, can you explain where this desire to write, to record, came from, to be a bearer of witness of everything that was happening in your city when you were a child, in the way that Anne Frank was able to bear witness to World War II?
I think it started, you know, I started writing my diary before the war started, never believing that that's something that could happen to me. So the only witness that I thought I would bear to would have been my own life, my own happy, ideal childhood, you know, birthday parties and holidays and who I had a crush on and what music I listened to, and, you know, something that would never be of any interest except make me and my friends laugh maybe in 10, 20, 30 years time. So I started writing my diary because I guess I'm a little bit of a hoarder of memories, and I like remembering things and leaving, kind of feeling like there's little crumbs of me left through time. And a diary was a way to do that. But really, quite innocently, you know, I started writing it when I was 9 because I had a friend who was 3 years older than me and had a diary. and she was so cool. So I wanted to sort of emulate her and be cool like her. And that's why I started. And then I'd read a fictional diary of a guy called Adrian Mole, which was written by an English woman. And it was a very sort of funny diary. And I thought, oh, so I'm going to be cool like my friend Martina and write a diary. Then I'm going to be funny like Adrian Mole. And I'd read the diary of Anne Frank, and I liked the idea that she named it and that it was a, you know, a confidant you could have. So I thought, oh, okay, I like that. I'll name my diary something. And obviously never, ever, ever in my wildest dreams or fears thinking that one day a parallel would be drawn.
When the Freedom Writers were able to get access to this book, some of the elements that they loved was, here's this little girl who's the same age as us across the globe, and she listens to Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam, and she wears Doc Martens. Your stories start out very innocent, and then the war creeps upon you, and you go from going to school and playing on a playground to being in a basement, recording these atrocities that happened around the city of Sarajevo. Can you talk about how your diary shifted?
I mean, I think that the school was such a big signifier that something is wrong, you know, losing school and the ability to go to school, which was very immediate, you know. I mean, it was a Sunday morning and I was trying to write an essay for class next day. And then we heard gunshots and explosions, and that, you know, you knew you wouldn't go to school the next day. But I think there's this kind of disbelief anyway at the start of war, because you never thought it would happen to you, because it happens to other people. Even when it does happen to you, you don't believe it's happening. And it's almost like, oh, this is like a snowstorm, so maybe we won't go to school for a few days. And that's kind of okay. But after a couple of days, when this started feeling more and more real and I wasn't going to school, that was a real sign that something was wrong. School was taken away, and then my friends started leaving because they were trying to kind of go to other places where they thought they would be safe, again thinking they'll only be gone for a week or so and then they'll come back. There were these conversations between my parents and I, you know, will I go, will I stay, will I go with my mom, but then my dad stays, and how do we navigate that? And then, you know, water reductions began and electricity reductions, so things were kind of going quieter and darker, but louder outside with these explosions. And there was this kind of weird month of these terrible noises and sounds outside, but still this disbelief that it's happening. And then there was this day a month into it, the 2nd of May, that I'll never forget, and there was a tank in front of my house, and the post office opposite my house, which was the main post office for the whole city, was in flames, and our telephone lines were cut, and we sat in this dark, smelly cellar for 10 hours, 12 hours, just listening to explosions and pounding outside. And this is when we knew, okay, this is really real, this is really serious. And from there on, more and more loss of normality. Then the water was totally cut, then the electricity was cut, and gas, and there was no food and shops and work for my parents, and danger was in every moment. You know, you went to these basements to hide, but, you know, then heard stories of people being hurt who were in basements. Then you hear that, you know, somebody you went to school with was playing in a park and a shrapnel hit them and they died. And you hear of people that your, you know, parents, co-workers and their friends are dying and being wounded, and maybe then your uncle is, you know, very badly wounded and they think they're going to amputate his leg, and you don't leave the house and you don't see your grandparents and or any friends or anyone your age, and your entire reality is utterly, utterly changed, turned upside down and inside out. When we had no electricity, there was no TV. So, but for a little while in advance of this, you were seeing these kind of arguments on television between politicians and shouting at each other and calling each other names and, you know, push and pull. And I was going, oh my God, they're worse than somebody in the playground. They feel like, you know, little kids fighting in a playground. And I guess that's why I call them kids, that, you know, those kids that stole our, you know, our real kids' childhoods and real kids' lives and prospects and realities and everything that every child in the world deserves.
In your book, there's a passage that I've always loved. It was written in 1992, and you use this metaphor of the pencil of war. And once again, these kids, the adults, put labels on all the citizens, a C for Croat, an M for Muslim, an S for Serb. Can you talk about that pencil of war and how horrific those labels were for people who never had used those labels prior to the war?
Yeah, there was a day, you know, I remember in the playground just outside of my house, the same playground where a couple of months later a shell fell and hurt all the kids, real kids, my friends who were playing in that playground. But a couple of months before that horrible day when, you know, this young girl that I went to kindergarten with, Nina, was killed, and lots of these others, people that I knew my age, a little bit older, a little bit younger, were wounded. A couple of months before this war started, I went into that same park and I was asked, "What are you?" And I went, "What do you mean? You know, what am I?" You know, I was raised in a way in which I was never taught about the difference and existence of all these different groups. So I had no idea about others and no idea about my own. And I kind of really had no idea. So I ran back home and I went, "I'm being asked what I am in the playground. Kind of, what do I say? What am I?" And my parents, I can't remember if it was my mom or dad, but or both probably, they were like, "Well, you're a girl, so go back into the playground and play, and that's tell them that." This idea that it suddenly was becoming important who you were, and the fact that you started, you know, recognizing from names, it's that surname, so that must mean that they are. And you didn't even want to think this. It became a reality, and it became almost an automatic response of your brain that you were placing things or confused when you weren't quite clear what they were. And you didn't even want this to exist in your head, but the situation and the reality around was bringing that into all of our brain spaces and our realities, and was making it important who you were. What was your surname? What was your father's name? What was your mother's name? And none of that ever, you know, was something that was raised in my family, that was ever discussed. And only after learning that this exists and some people ascribe importance to it, did I learn that all these people in our lives, our family, friends, my parents' friends, my, you know, classmates, people that I loved and hung out with and had fun with, that, you know, these guys were this and those guys were that, and that this exists, you know, and that we had this diversity of friends, but that we didn't even know were diverse because they were just good people that we had shared same values with.
You know, when we read that in my class with my students, it was almost the exact opposite. Long Beach had gone through such civil strife, specifically because people overtly had a label. I'm African American, I'm an Asian immigrant, I am Latino. And I think that your innocence and almost righteous indignation about the labels allowed us to have this great discussion about labels. And so when they met you and you were asked firsthand about what you are, and you very defiantly said, "I'm a human being," it was this liberating moment for the Freedom Riders to think, maybe all those labels that they put on us all these years, or the labels we put on ourselves, don't matter. And I want you to talk about the power of labels, because I think that you've, in such a dignified way, since you were this 11-year-old girl, have really tried to fight labels.
Thank you for calling it dignified. I think it was just simple and, you know, right. I don't think it, you know, I don't think it even came from any, you know, it probably came from that go back to the playground, you're a girl, and you know, what it is that my parents taught me. It's a kind of a fine line because on the one hand, you know, heritage and tradition and things like that, you know, are something that I don't think should be entirely dismissed. But once there's a sort of a hierarchy or a scale, or, you know, that is placed on labels, well, then that upsets me. And, you know, I think we could all benefit globally from just easing up on those labels, because the moment, you know, I'm still, even today, I'm kind of uneasy when people get flags out and, you know, national songs, and, you know, they sort of, it's this kind of innate desire to belong to a group so you're not left out alone, and maybe you'll be safer and protected by the group, and maybe you won't have to face yourself if you're belonging to the group, because you won't have to ask questions about who you are, because it's just going to be about what you are and who you belong to. And I think there's, you know, liberating yourself from the labels whilst, like I say, not, you know, trampling on, if that's what's important to you, traditions and heritage, etc. But liberating yourself from that can lead to a great enlightenment, I think. But I think back in the day, it was just quite simple. You know, I am a girl, I am a human being, and shall remain so forever.
One of the most poignant things I remember of being in Bosnia was the Olympic rings. So Sarajevo was the site of the Winter Olympics in 1984. And Los Angeles, where the Freedom Riders are from, was the site of the Summer Olympics in 1984. And I remember seeing the Olympic rings and beneath those rings, all of these grave sites. So I don't think people realize the magnitude of this beautiful city, Sarajevo, where the entire world was watching. And then suddenly the entire world had forgotten. Can you paint a picture of the city that hosted a world event, and then those shots ring out in the dead of night, and it seems as if everybody forgot you?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of funny because I think a lot of the time people were bringing up the fact that we had the Winter Olympics, again, as though that's something that can protect you from having a war, you know, but we hosted the Olympics. Surely that protects us. And, you know, I was a kid, you know, so I don't remember it, except there's just pictures of me with the mascot and, you know, stories of my parents telling me that we went, me learning how to ski as a result of this event. But, you know, they felt, and I possibly inherited some of those memories from them, that the whole world was watching Sarajevo. They were, you know, if you're into Olympics, and they maybe were even bigger back then than they are now. Now we have so many other events. It was. And then we did feel forgotten, because once this began and, you know, we were kind of waiting for, because we were powerless, we were going, well, was anyone else going to stop this? I mean, this is madness, you know. Civilians, kids, grannies, grandpas, you know, families are being expelled, are being, you know, killed, are being raped, maimed. I mean, the worst was happening. So we are powerless. And will the world, this same world that watched us and we hosted, and, you know, will they not do something? And we felt forgotten. And what's kind of been astounding is, with the perspective of time and learning about other conflicts and meeting people, I realized that the fact that we were a European country, we probably got way more attention than so many other conflicts around the world. And that's sad, you know, that we felt forgotten. And can you imagine how some of those others who are truly forgotten, you know, feel? The city was, you know, completely changed. You know, you had these ghosts and shells of buildings. We used to call them Swiss cheese, because they had so many holes in them from various, you know, shells going through, things burnt, the National Library with all the books inside, the post office. People just, you know, living in darkness and, you know, very cold. You know, Bosnia can get very cold in the winter, dragging bits of wood, cutting trees from parks because they needed something to warm themselves with and cook with. And, you know, lines of people dragging water. I mean, it looks, you know, post-apocalyptic. It looks like, you know, The Road. It looks like, you know, Mad Max. You know, the conditions, the sort of what we were worn down to as humans, as humanity. And yes, the city parks became city graveyards. And underneath those Olympic rings lay the victims of the war.
What I tried to do with the Freedom Riders was explain a war in a country and geography that they were not familiar with. And I did so, ironically, by using basketball. The former Yugoslavian teammates, Vlade Divac and Toni Kukoc, were roommates and on your national team. And in America, they were on these two rival basketball teams. Vlade Divac was on the Los Angeles Lakers, and Toni Kukoc was on the Chicago Bulls. And I tried to explain the war in terms of, imagine gang rivalry, where you grew up with your best friend and you play basketball, and suddenly when you grow up, one of you joined this gang and the other one joins that gang. And you don't always know how it started or why. You just know that you're no longer friends. And so for our listeners who don't understand the how and the why of this war, could you make sense of the madness for a kid to understand? Because I'm still grappling with how do I make sense of the madness of gang warfare. So Slata, do you even understand how and why the war began?
I mean, big question, you know, and I probably don't, you know, because in the kind of core of me, I don't ever understand why there should be one, you know. And you can look at the mechanisms of how one comes about. And I think those mechanisms are worth studying, you know, and learning so you can learn how to prevent them or resolve them. But it was led by, you know, a sense of identities and nationalism and us versus them versus the third guys and the fourth guys and a harking back to historical and flags and songs, that all of which arouses these, you know, identities where it matters that who you are and who they are, and there's different value ascribed to who you are and who they are. And those are the kind of mechanisms under which this happened. I mean, you can talk about the fact that, you know, different republics in Yugoslavia wanted to gain independence. And, you know, but again, that's also tied into we don't want to be a part of a bigger thing. We want to be ourselves because of our identity. So it's definitely tied very much into identity politics.
So I remember we finished reading the book and the Freedom Riders desperately wanted to meet you. You're a world away. And one night I am on Renee Firestone's couch. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And Renee Firestone, this dear Holocaust survivor, said, I met Slata. And I have a holiday card from her. And maybe we can find her. And I remember Renee reaching out to you. It was like a message in a bottle. And we made contact with you. And what was that like for this crazy teacher and 150 students to reach out to you and send you letters and this invitation to hop on a plane with your mother, your father, and your best friend and come to Long Beach, California?
Yeah, I'll never forget that. I mean, I still have that pack of letters that you guys sent that were colorful and bright, and all the enthusiasm and energy and joy that you guys shared, and obviously led by you. And you know, it was amazing. And the invitation to come and your openness and generosity to bring, you know, because I was only 15 and I, you know, that's not very big still, you know, being 15. I met, you know, my parents were important. And at the time, my best friend Mirna, who we helped get out of Sarajevo to come and stay with us and be safe and live with us, you know, that was very generous of you to invite all four of us and host us so amazingly and to meet you all.
And I think back to the passage about that pencil of war, that C, the M, the S. With the four of you, it was seeing the eraser to the pencil of war, because back in Sarajevo, Mirna would have an S, your father would have an M, and your mother would have a C, and you were this perfect blend of all of them. And I think for the Freedom Riders, it allowed us to realize to get out that eraser and erase the label that they had on themselves, either that they had given themselves or society had given them. So I think having all four of you was so powerful, because it allowed us to ask so many questions.
I just find it fascinating how you know, managed to use something like, you know, now with the perspective of time as well, that a war diary of a kid from Sarajevo, so many thousands and thousands of miles away, managed to make sense to a group as diverse as yours in Long Beach, California. You know, that will forever astound me, that there was a sort of an understanding that they read, you know, the diary of Anne Frank, that they met Renee and, you know, us, you know, my parents and Mirna and I, and that all that made sense. And it did. And I possibly wasn't even able to kind of, you know, feel or articulate what it is. And you know, but it was a bit of alchemy that all that blended together and made sense and raised us all above where we were. And that's quite beautiful.
I love that we were able to come visit you in Bosnia after the Freedom Riders graduated. And it was bringing history to life. Every relic and building that you mentioned, we were now seeing. The bridge where you would zigzag so you wouldn't get hit by a shell, the opera house, the schools. And I think that the ability to touch and feel and still be afraid and yet be with you and feel safe was indescribable. What was it like to host Freedom Riders on your soil?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was another mad, brilliant idea, you know, and not that long after the war had stopped, you know. It wasn't, you know, going to visit Sarajevo 20 years later, as people do now. It was very brave and inspired and cool. And obviously, you know, it's a very different place 2-3 years after the war to the place that it is now, you know, in terms of that proximity of war in everything that you can feel and touch and see. So it was an inspired visit for sure. And we had lots of fun. And I think you guys had a big trip around Europe where you were able to then further make these links between the past, the recent past and the present, with your students. And we had a lot of fun.
So I remember you moved to Ireland, you go to school at Oxford, and when you chose a profession, you chose a profession that takes us back to that diary. You were this best-selling author as a teenager, and your chosen profession is to be a filmmaker, and all of the stories that you tell, either through your writing or through your films, are taking care of the other. And so can you explain how that has evolved? Your childhood has made you this activist who gives a voice to the voiceless.
I mean, it was very important for me growing up to not forever be associated with the diary. And I had an opportunity to see my diary be put into a stage play when I was 22. And it was amazingly well done. But it was insane and bizarre that, you know, age 22, I'm watching other people play out my life as though I am 90. And, you know, I needed to also figure out a way to not reject, but also not forever be defined, not forever be thought of as, you know, 12 and 13. You know, the diary was a window into my life in Sarajevo, but it wasn't just my life. It could have been anyone else's diary. And I was always very aware, and I still am very aware of that. It happened to be me. It could have been any other girls or young boys that could have been published. And I found myself in a situation of almost an accidental activist, because people wanted to hear about my life. But by speaking about my life, I was speaking about my best friend and our neighbors and my grandparents and everything that we were going through, again, in the hope that if people really learn more about this, that something will be done to stop it, so that my best friend and my cousins and my neighbors and my grandparents would no longer have to be going through what they were going through. So it was a sort of an accidental activist age 13, because it was scary, you know, it was scary to go on like massive live shows on CNN and, you know, and with Charlie Rose and, you know, get up at 4 a.m. for some early morning show and meet presidents of countries and all this sort of strange stuff. But I did it because I was going, well, you know, people want to know about Bosnia. So if I tell them, maybe that'll make some sort of a difference. People want to know about Sarajevo and what the siege and what life is like. So that was the accidental activist. And then there was a student and, you know, somebody who wanted to also just listen to Eddie Vedder and have Doc Martens and, you know, like boys and be invited to parties and go to college. And then the kind of mid-20s kind of thing hits, where you're like, okay, there's a theater play of my life. I can't just be that. Who else am I beyond student and beyond Zlata of Zlata's Diary? And I guess somewhere there, I you know, like I said, I was always wondering what were the other diaries that were written by other kids in Sarajevo who could be here talking to you if their diary was published. And I made a collection, you know, together with a lovely young writer, Melanie Challenger, which was called Stolen Voices, which is a collection of other young people's diaries. And that was a sort of a step away, young people's diaries in different wars throughout 20th century, you know, other quote-unquote Zlatas through time and space. And, you know, it's so unfortunate that this continues. It's like this, you know, we talked of pencils a lot. It's like this very sad pencil of war gets passed on from generation to generation. And that's what Stolen Voices is, you know, is written by this pencil being passed on from 1914 to 2006. It unfortunately keeps writing and the pages are added on and added on. And that was a half step away from my own diary, but still helping others tell stories and getting other people's stories out. And I guess that then led into filmmaking or documentary filmmaking, largely, which is again another way of telling stories that maybe otherwise wouldn't be heard, or inhabiting spaces and lives that perhaps will make us, maybe even a few of us, slightly change our view of something or learn something. And that's where there's a sort of satisfaction and massive responsibility, and I enjoy that. So that's been the last 11 years of my life.
When you choose film projects, what is something that says, okay, I need to make a documentary about that, or I need to publish a book about that? What is your driving force?
I think there's a kind of a collaboration, I guess, with people that I trust and like. Some of my friends and colleagues that I've worked with, you know, people with whom I share, you know, similar values. I guess with each time, you know, there's something a little bit more that opens people's eyes. And that's amazing when you make something that can actually maybe even, you know, inspire a ripple of some sort of a, you know, legislative change, or you know, just opening minds to other stories, other lives, making those who are open to receive them broader, wider, better, I guess is a real kind of honor to be able to do that if done right.
Because you are a teacher of humanity and you so eloquently stood on that stage with that microphone all those years ago and proclaimed in front of the Freedom Writers and myself, I am a human being. What would you proclaim today if you could be in a room full of people to inspire them to do right and be just?
I think especially in the time that we live in now, it feels like, you know, there are quite a lot of hard and difficult times, and times when our kind of faith in goodness and this shared humanity and kindness and compassion and love can be really, really shaken. I think our kind of greatest sort of maybe homework now is to rise above that and continue believing in each other, continue believing in goodness. Maybe I am complete optimist, maybe I am naive, but I kind of feel even more so, you know, in spite of everything around us, if we can keep kind of being open to quieting ourselves and listening to others and loving others and believing in others and believing in goodness and acting in a way in which we can inspire more of it, from the smallest interactions we have with somebody in our local shop to how we learn and teach and work and engage and lead. I think it's with that sort of heart now more than ever that we need to do that with. A belief there is a light, even if you can't see it now, you know, that light will come and be open to it and seek it out and create it within yourself and for others. For me, I'm quite a hopeful person, and you know, it's actually a line from Anne Frank's diary, despite it all, I kind of still believe that people are good, and that belief, and also this lovely, lovely phrase of this lovely poem that I have from a Chinese poet that's kind of like 5th century BC, and it's sort of, it says all things pass, you know, the sunshine and the rain, and you know, things come in waves, and there are dark times, and I guess it's the belief that they'll go and sun will shine, and even when the sun is shining an awful lot, there'll be a dark day's coming, but that's okay. And it's about keeping that constant between those and believing in better days too.
In honor of their truth, may we all use that pencil to create and not destroy. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier with production assistance from Clay Amontorp. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please share it with your students, your colleagues, your friends, and family. And if you feel inspired, please leave us a review. It helps the podcast grow so we continue to have that message of hope and freedom for everyone who listens. Our call to action today is this. May we look past society's stereotypes and labels. May we believe in better days. And as Lotta so beautifully declared, may we always remember that no matter where we come from, no matter who we are all human beings. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.